ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Waleed, what do you and I have in common?
We're both miserable people, Hamish, destroying the world with our pessimism.
At least that's what Michael Kirby thinks. One of Australia's greatest minds, greatest legal minds for sure, says that maybe we're just not optimistic enough. The world will become a better place. I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Waleed Ali. Let's go roaming if we have to.
Well, Waleed, here we are for the second part of this wonderful conversation with Justice Kirby. Look, I'm doing it too now. He did tell us not to call him Judge or Justice.
Don't you call him Mike? Isn't that how it normally works?
Yeah, I walked in calling him Michael at the beginning of this, and then you got into a tangle with him about Judge and Justice. And anyway, here we are. Look, there was so much in that first episode, North Korea, the cutting of US aid internationally, the flow-on effects of that, whether Trump will go for another term. And yet, there is still a lot more to talk to Michael Kirby about. And by the way, I'll just flag with listeners, we did sort of get lightly scolded by Michael Kirby in the latter part of this conversation. So I would suggest that you listen out for that.
So here's the second part of our conversation with Michael Kirby. I'm intrigued by your confidence in the international rules-based order, Judge, I have to say. I have to confess I don't see a lot of it in evidence, especially from the purveyors of the rules-based order. One of the really stark distinctions, it seems to me, between the way that someone like George W. Bush waged war and the way that Donald Trump wages it is not that they would violate the rules-based order. I think it's pretty clear George W. Bush did that as well. It's that George W. Bush at least tried to concoct some kind of legal argument within it, whereas Donald Trump doesn't even bother.
Concocting, as you so unkindly put it, the world needs the United Nations. If we don't have it, things go bad. And things are going bad in the AIDS and other pandemics at the moment. And I hope we can get back to the rules-based order, because otherwise, in that area, AIDS, HIV/AIDS, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to die.
What are you talking about there? Are you talking about the removal of funding from things like USAID, the impact that's having in Africa, in Fiji, even in the Pacific? Is that what you're referring to?
That's certainly one of the things, and a very big thing, and that is a major problem. The UN pitched its objective at end of AIDS by 2030. That was the big policy when I was last in serving in a number of UN bodies on HIV/AIDS. But I got a speech made about a week ago by the executive director of the United Nations program on AIDS, UNAIDS, to a meeting of the African Union in, I think it was in Kenya, wherever it was held. She spoke about the importance of gender values and that they are important in the struggle against HIV. But I looked through the speech, I combed through it for any mention of homosexual or of same-sex activities, and that was never backwards. People, that was front, centre and very important in the UN strategy. But there was nothing about that. And in fact, I've written a letter to her.
Why? Because what's your suspicion? That it's just politically too complicated to say that,
well,
to put that in print?
Of course it's complicated. In Africa it's complicated, and in the Caribbean, because, and in Eastern Europe, because there are these political strategies that designed to whip up anxiety and hatred of gay people, We in Australia know what all that tastes like because we saw that certainly in my youth. And the way to some extent that we made progress was by giving it a name and talking about the reasons why some people got infected and what we could do, even before the antiretroviral drugs came along, what we could do to stop that. And therefore, we got into the habit of speaking a name, LGBTIQ, and people who have, men who have sex with men. And that is really important and was part of the strategy, which even without the antiretrovirals was a very important part of the United Nations response, and it was powerful and it was communicated.
But what then do you make of the fact that so many of these steps forward seem to be being pushed back in so many parts of the world right now?
Well, I don't like it, but I think what we have, people of knowledge and people who know what we did when HIV came along, and people who think about what we will do when the next pandemic comes along, the fundamental lesson which Jonathan Mann back in the 1980s spread was you've got to reach out to people who are most at risk, and you've got to engage them, and you're not got to criminalise them and to try to take them away from the messages. And that, with the antiretrovirals, was a very important part of the UN strategy, and it was a very successful part. Combine that with the funding for the antiretrovirals and for the mosquito nets and so on, that was a way you could reduce pandemics. But if you're going to take away the calling a name to the causes of the spread, then you're not going to be able to get there to the objective.
But the far right, which is on the march in many parts of the world right now, does seem to gain a lot of political traction by targeting some of these groups, whether it's trans or gay or whatever it is.
Well, that's true.
There's enormous political mileage, it would seem, despite all of the work of your lifetime in this space.
Well, it's true that there is progress of rather unpleasant forces. But then you've got to think of President Orban, and you've got to think that there are places where a society stands up against it, and in very large numbers, because the genie is out of the bottle. People know and observe and can be told about how we turned around the HIV pandemic. In Australia, we were just very fortunate to have a government at the time, the Hawke government, and a minister, Neil Blewett, a leader, a member in the opposition, Professor Peter Bohm, who brought these truths to the public and to the experts, and that worked. But there is a turn of the tide, and we've got to make sure that the tide turns back to what we learned about HIV, because it will be still true today and it will be true for other pandemics.
You're listening to Global Roaming from Radio National. It's Hamish here with Waleed, and we're speaking to the Honourable Michael Kirby, one of Australia's most brilliant legal minds.
I don't recall a time in my lifetime where appeals to overarching notions such as human rights or multilateral organisations or even international organisations like the UN has been less persuasive. In other words, the esteem of this whole thing just seems to me in huge state of disrepair. And can we be confident that the currents simply reverse at some point? Or are we watching something more profound than that?
Well, you get me at a very vulnerable point, because I read this speech by the successor to Jonathan Mann and Peter Peart and Michel Sidibé, the three leaders of UNAIDS. And now I see a different tune being sung, and I don't like it, and it's not going to be effective. It's going to cost lives. But you poor things, you're spending your whole life dealing with crises and horrible things. Out there in the world, there are a lot of very good things being done by the international community. For example, I think the international community is now decisively waking up to the problem of climate change. And if you've been in Sydney, Australia, in the last couple of weeks, it's been freezing, and much. I mean, maybe I'm getting more sensitive to freezing.
I think you might be. I think it's been a warm winter.
Oh, it's a horrible winter.
So I'm in Melbourne, and everything's balmy all the time in Melbourne. It's very hard to relate to this.
Yes. Well, anyway, we won't get into that silly national argument. But I think we've just got to be a little bit patient. And Orban shows that not only was this a political movement, but it was a popular movement. It was a lot of people. And the Hungarians don't have such a glorious history that you could write that off. That was unusual, and that was wonderful. And we've got to look to the countries in which lawyers have taken cases to courts, and courts have overruled some of the laws against gay people. And there are a sprinkling of countries, but sadly, there's also more than a sprinkling of countries in Africa and in the Caribbean and in Eastern Europe who are particularly nasty to gay people, egged on, I think, I can say, by religion and by people who want to punish people because God wants to punish them. But what are we going to do? Just roll over and say we're sorry about this and it's all sad and so on? We've got to stand up against it. And the United Nations usually gives leadership on doing so. Against the pressure of many countries in the world, the UN three times has elected a special rapporteur on sexual orientation and gender identity. And that is a sort of litmus test, but it's been voted for. I think that's what we've got to watch for, and we've got to further. And in our national policy, we've got to ensure that our government propounds that of either side of the equation, because it is, I think, something we in Australia have made some progress on.
How then do you explain the way that issue, gender identity, has become a feature of both democracies and autocracies the world over? The potency of that trans discussion is quite profound.
It is very, it's very distressing, actually. I think trans are a curious minority and they need to go out more. They need to be more seen. They need to be more visible. Now that I go to universities and I speak to young law students, every now and again somebody will come up and say, thank you for what you've done for LGBT, I'm trans. And I don't think many people have met the trans. And when you do and you realise this is fundamentally a person who feels very uncomfortable in their body and in their body image and in their appearance and in their interests, I think most people who are rational will say, well, I don't quite understand that, just as I didn't quite understand gay people, but that's part of the tapestry of humanity, so I've just got to get over it. And I think that is apparently what Orban had to face in Hungary. They had the biggest pride gatherings in Hungary, of all places. And it then was tested in an election and it changed the leadership of Hungary. So you're a bit too pessimistic. Maybe you're paid to be pessimistic and to present pessimistic images and get everybody excited and upset and unhappy. But I am an optimist. And in my lifetime, don't forget, I've seen First Nations people honoured and with rights protected, not perfect, long way from perfect. I've seen women get rights that they didn't have. I've seen LGBT get rights. I've seen people of colour and people of different cultures and religions. So we've made a lot of progress in Australia, and I think likewise we can get progress elsewhere, but it needs a teacher. It needs a Mr. Gibbons to give the cane every now and again. And if we don't have somebody who will start speaking back, then the others get a free kick. You've got to work at that and not just give it up because there's a temporary period of people who are not of the same view.
It's interesting you say it's a temporary period, though. I think this is the big philosophical assumption that belies everything you're saying, and I think so many of the arguments that are now taking place in the public sphere, cast even into the international realm. You're presenting, it seems to me, a view of history and progress that is more or less unidirectional, that it proceeds from point A and it goes to point B, and in the long run, point B is better than point A. I mean, correct me if that's not what you're saying, but that's how it sounds to me. And that's a big assumption. It's also an assumption that is really unusual in human history. Like, it's an Enlightenment presumption. But most human beings throughout our species history haven't seen the world that way. They see recursion, they see circularity, they see all of these sorts of things, rather than things that just kind of move, if not frictionlessly, then inexorably in a particular direction.
Well, I think if I can give you a little bit of a prescription, I think you should both sit down at night and watch, as I do on YouTube, the planets, and see the mighty universe, see Mars, and see horrible Venus and frightful Mercury.
Sorry, what have you got against Venus?
Venus, it's horrible. It's clouded in terrible dust, and as well as that, it has radiation, which makes it completely uninhabitable for humans. You can't do a Trump real estate program in Venus.
And well, there's no saving it then, clearly.
So I think we have made great progress. Universal education, and let me say also in an Australian context, public education, supporting fine education, especially in public schools, to all people, that really plays to our rationality. And the rationality that had scientists and ultimately people like Alfred Kinsey and others revealing the truths about sexual orientation, that it's no big deal. It's always been there and it's not terribly harmful to individuals, and we should just get on with the rest of it, get used to it.
For people living, working in the world today and trying to solve some of the problems that are in front of us, I mean, it's incredible to hear you describe your optimism about climate change, because I reckon a lot of people my generation would not feel that sense of optimism that the world is somehow turning a corner on HIV and AIDS. For all the advances and the possibility that medicine presents us with, there are terrible statistics coming out of the Pacific, out of Africa right now because of some of what you've described. Or even when it comes to the rule of law, all we need do is look at the United States and the relationship between the Trump administration and the justice system in America. There would be people that really struggle to think, well, if I just watch YouTube at night and look at the planets, it'll all fall into some perspective and I'll feel a bit more optimistic.
And by the way, how bad's Venus?
Well, I'm not thinking of a visit to Venus, nor Mercury, nor Pluto, nor any of them. They're all awful. Here are we on this little blue planet, and on the way to the moon, they turned the cameras round and they captured our little blue, beautiful planet. And we've got this species which by accidents developed and has a consciousness and a consciousness of itself. And we've developed education and we've developed universal education. We've got many things going for us. I think you're paid. That's the problem with the Radio National. You're paid to see the crises and to present them, and every day is a new crisis. Okay, the last 4 years or 5 years or 10 years have not all been all that lovely. But the human species has continued to evolve, I think, and we've got to make sure that we just don't rent our clothes and gnash our teeth. we've got to put great emphasis on getting national leaders. And I think we have definitely made progress. I know just watching the courts. The courts are now much more likely in matters of environmental concern and matters involving giving another coal mine the opportunity to develop in a beautiful, pristine area of nature in Australia, the courts will strike that down. And the courts will refer to the Paris platform and the developments of international law. So, you know, we've got to be more optimistic, and we've got to use opportunities, and we've got to teach opportunities. It's easy to give up, but I won't give up.
I do think, though, that I wonder if the analysis you're offering, though, misses a crucial plank here, that this is not a straight up and down battle between the rational and the irrational. This is not a matter of simply better educating ignorant people or anything like that. That there is something of a crisis of legitimacy that we're watching here, whereby institutions, they are captured by what so many people in broad populations regard as distant elites. And that the whole language of we are rational and we will promulgate our rationality for you to benefit from and thereby direct the way that society should be going. That's the very impulse that triggers the rejection, that is seen as undemocratic, spurning of the interests, the desires, the worldview, the practical experience of the masses who perhaps didn't do PhDs or sit on high court benches or whatever it might be. I think I just detect that there is a broader mood going on that is far deeper than the way that we're describing it in this conversation.
Well, I think there are great moves, and a lot of them are very annoying and seem very irrational. Some of them are due to embrace of religious extremism. And how can one deal with that except by the antidote? And the antidote is factual information, different opinions, and making sure that people get the full picture and don't get too excited that for a period of 5-10 years, things go through a bad patch. That's the nature of mankind and humanity. But we've got to put our money on the rational, the consciousness of humanity, turn the cameras back on our world, see how trivial we are in terms of the universe, and make sure that we work together. And when there is a problem in a country, we've got to call out that problem. And that's why when I saw UNAIDS, which previously under wonderful leadership did very brave and difficult things, when I saw that they've fallen into tongue-tied silence about LGBT issues, that is a reversion from what was being done. And that has to be called out and it has to be dealt with. And if the UN leadership takes it upon itself against maybe some political problems to do so, then we'll make some real progress. But we don't just wash our hands and say, well, this is all difficult. It is difficult, but it can be changed.
Michael Covey, you've been incredibly generous with your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on Radio National.
That'll be the promo. That was Michael Covey in conversation with Waleed and myself. Pessimistic. Do you think we're too pessimistic?
Well, this is an impossible question to answer, isn't it, Hamish? Because I think he's too optimistic. And actually more than that, and I basically said this to him. I think he encapsulates a particular worldview that is straight up and down liberal. And I think it's a big assumption to say that that holds sway and is simply coming back, that there's like a correction that is in the offing, you know, that well, this is the default, this is the way things are, you know, capital letters, and this is just a mere blip and a deviation and things will return to, I don't see the evidence for that. He might be right. Who am I to argue with Justice Kirby? but I find that an orthodoxy that is just very easily accepted by people of a liberal disposition rather than one that reckons with the post-liberalism of the moment.
Well, I suppose there's an argument, right, that in this age of disruption, it may be an exponential, you know, growth curve, that the more disruption comes, you know, that will lead to even further and steeper forms of disruption. And that doesn't fit with the, you know, I guess the outlook that Michael is describing there. I'm not sure I quite understand what you mean by it being a classic liberal view of the world, because I think, isn't it the liberals that seem to be incredibly upset about the state of the world today and feel that, the changes we're experiencing must be fought at every turn?
Yeah, but I do think that's what he thinks. I think he's just an optimistic liberal. But I think the basic assumptions, you know, the idea that we move from position A to via progress to somewhere else, that it is a battle between rationality and irrationality, that education will solve all these problems. That's a very liberal view of the world. Mm. It's a view that
And it assumes that people accept rational argument, right? Part of, a feature of our life today is the willingness of people to look past evidence and rationality.
Well, but see, I would thicken the conversation more than that. That I don't think it's about there are people who accept rationality and there are people who don't. I think it's that the concept of rationality is up for grabs. Exactly what it connotes is up for grabs. And that the really big thing that I think might be going on in politics is this debate over whether rationality is itself enough or a meaningful guide. And that's a huge philosophical debate that is not simply about people who are uneducated and people who are educated. It's so much more than that. I mean, you know,
because what rationally I can understand these statistics and what outcome that might point me towards, but instinctively I feel something else.
Yeah, you can tell me X is true, but if everything in my experience says it's not. And we are also living in a world where so much of the populist response is, look at all these experts who told us how to order the world and look what a mess it's become. Mm. Why am I believing these people? Why am I relying on these people when they throw up all these crazy economic policies and these crazy social policies and this change that, you know, completely disrupts my patterns of living and all these sorts of things? Pre-Enlightenment, people understood that reason was really important, but that people were not just rational, but they were also rationalizing. And so that the idea that you can just be rational and that that's not rationalizing some other impulse that itself needs to be guided, that's a really big assumption. And I think it's just taken hold of us so much in societies like, I don't hold myself as an exception to this, by the way. But it's taken hold of us in so much that we don't even recognize how big an assumption it is. And the disruption that we see comes along in the form of a Trump or a Farage or whatever. It's not perfectly theorized. That's not, you know, there's a lot that's wrong with it. But what it's doing, and the reason it seems so radical to us, is it's questioning an assumption we barely even understood we were making. Now, maybe that assumption will hold, and maybe Justice Kirby's view of the world will hold. I hear Michael Kirby talk about the importance of seeing people more. He's talking about in the context of transgender people. And I think that's right. We need to see each other more. But sometimes that requires also seeing people who are across the other side of a deep philosophical divide, rather than merely assuming that they can be cured through rationality and education as though they are irrational people by nature or something like that. That doesn't mean his view of the future will be wrong. I just think it's really, really complicated.
global.roaming@abc.net.au is the email address. I'd really like to hear what you think about this conversation with Michael Kirby. Waleed, I'll see you next time.
Shall do. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.